May it please the court. My name is Matthew Grove, registration number 34269. I'm here on behalf of the Secretary of State. This case is important, not just because of the specific rules that are at issue, but because it involves a challenge that goes to the very scope of an administrative agency's rulemaking authority. The plaintiffs do more here than just complain about the substance of the rules. Their challenge is actually more fundamental than that. It's aimed at the rulemaking process itself. While the plaintiffs obviously do take issue with the substance of the regulations that the Secretary adopted, the main thrust of their argument is that the Secretary didn't have authority to conduct rulemaking on these subjects at all. While the stated reasons for this position vary somewhat among the several rules that are at issue here, the plaintiff's main thrust is this: that an administrative agency may only make rules that do not add to, modify, or conflict with existing law. We agree with that. And that an agency's ability to clarify ambiguities in existing law only exists when the subject laws suffer from constitutional vagueness problems. As I'll explain in a moment, that argument fails for a number of reasons. Indeed, administrative rulemaking authority is far broader than the plaintiffs suggest. But before I get there, I'd like to mention a second and related overarching issue. This case does involve rulemaking, and so the general rules about the limits of administrative authority apply. But it's important to note at the outset that this case does not involve garden variety administrative rules. We're not talking about zoning or licensing or commercial activity. Instead, the rules at issue here relate directly to fundamental First Amendment rights, rights that the United States and the Colorado Supreme Courts have held not only will be guaranteed the highest degree of protection, but that also demand a high degree of certainty as to when and how they're going to apply. And it is certainty, more specifically certainty about to whom Colorado's campaign finance regulations will apply and exactly how they will do so, that is what these rules are all about.
Mr. Grove, I can interrupt you because I really would like you to get to the specific rules. I do understand your point. But on this one, because it does underlie a couple of the rules, you talk about the Secretary looking for certainty, and you know that's certainly a laudable goal. But what do you do in a situation where the Constitution defines a term, or the General Assembly has defined a term? Can the Secretary in that situation say, I don't think that's clear enough, so I'm going to add something to that definition, because that seems to be a part of their argument, at least as to some of the rules. So in that situation, the Constitution speaks to the definition, it defines the term, or the legislature defines the term. Can the Secretary in that situation make the determination that I don't think that definition is clear enough, so I'm going to adopt a rule that adds to it to make it clear?
If the definition is not clear enough, if the definition causes constitutional ambiguities, or if it causes, as the record reflects in this case, that there are massive problems with people trying to comply with it, then our position would be yes. I don't think that we have a situation here. And I think that the limit, where you draw the line here, is where a rule that's adopted by an administrative agency is what Sanger v. Dennis says, is adds to, modifies, or contravenes an existing statutory or constitutional.
All right, provision. So you're tracking with me exactly. So why doesn't, if the legislature has spoken, defined the term, why does, if the secretary then chooses to, let me add some definition because I think it'll be clear, why isn't that adding to it? I'm concerned with, you mentioned, I'm concerned with where do we draw the line?
The problem is with the specificity that the First Amendment demands. And if there is ambiguity in the way that it can be applied, and if when resorting to Supreme Court precedent, both U.S. Supreme Court and the Colorado Supreme Court and the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals and this court, all of which bind the Secretary in his interpretations of the law, and all of whose rulings could be used to prevent the Secretary from enforcing a particular regulation, if those pieces of precedent call into question, or more than that, clearly demonstrate that a particular statute or rule is going to be unconstitutional and cannot be enforced, then it's incumbent upon the Secretary to do something about it.
And so who has the power to review legislative statutes for constitutionality?
Well, the courts.
I mean, what I'm hearing is the Secretary of State can review a state law passed by the legislature, determine that it's unconstitutional, and change it to make it constitutional. Where does he get that power?
Well, it's certainly the primary authority of the judiciary to engage in constitutional review and determine whether something is constitutional or not.
Or the legislature. I mean, they read cases. They could say, let's fix this legislation. Could they not?
You run into some difficulty when you've got a constitutional amendment, which many of the rules...
Yeah, I'm talking about legislation.
Yeah, absolutely, certainly. The legislature can certainly review what a particular law says, what a particular piece of legislation says, and they can change that legislation to accord with constitutional requirements. However,
and the Secretary of State could go to them and bring this to their attention and encourage them to change it, and then he would be bound by their determination as to whether they wanted to change it.
And in many cases, the Secretary of State, both the current Secretary and previous Secretaries, have done so. However, there are many situations in which the legislature, for whatever reason, doesn't act. That may be political, it may be that there are other things on their agenda. There are lots of reasons for that. And when you are facing a very clear constitutional mandate, and a good example of this is the major purpose test, the Secretary can't simply bury his head in the sand and say, well, Amendment 27 doesn't say anything about a political committee having to have a major purpose. But that's been in the law since 1976 when Buckley versus Vallejo was decided. And to the extent that the political committee definition doesn't include major purpose as one of the requirements, that's plainly unconstitutional. And I suppose we could sit around and wait for it to be challenged in federal court, but it would be a clear loser.
Well, let me ask you about that, Mr. I'm sorry. Finish your sentence. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, I didn't have anything else to say on that.
Okay, I apologize. Well, let's focus on that. Rule 1.18.2. The argument justifying that, as I understand, is the Tenth Circuit and a division of this court both said the Secretary can't enforce this provision without the word major purpose. So the Secretary adopts a rule to incorporate that. I think you got a reasonable argument there, and I'll ask your colleagues about that. But the Secretary went further. Then the rule further goes on to define major purpose in terms of looking at the organizational documents and looking at the majority of expenses, which is under, I guess, issue committee, and put that in. Let's assume for argument's sake that you're right, that the Secretary could adopt a rule that reads in major purpose because other courts have said that's constitutionally required. Where's the authority for the Secretary to then add these other, the definition of major purpose into this particular rule?
I don't think that putting the 50% expenditure rule is adding anything to what Buckley required. The major purpose is defined as the preponderance of spending. At least it has been by many courts that have reviewed it. I'm not aware of any courts that say an organization has the major purpose if it spends less than 50% of whatever, 50% of whatever the relevant thing that you measure it against would be. Now, it's actually an interesting distinction if you look between the issue committee definition, which talks about a major purpose, and the political committee definition, which is silent. I think Amendment 27's use of a major purpose is a good indication that they intended to, that, sorry, Amendment 27 intended to have issue committees regulated more broadly than political committees. By using a major purpose, that was, you can presumably have more than one major purpose because that's going to be less than 50%. But when you have the major purpose, and that's what Buckley requires, and I don't think there's any dispute on that point, then it's completely consistent with the binding precedent for the Secretary to simply put that in words so people who are trying to comply with the statute can do it without being having the draconian consequences that are related with, incorrectly interpreting the statute and then failing to report hanging over their head.
Could the Secretary simply apply that when determining when to take corrective action, simply make the determination, here's the rule of thumb I'm going to use, and I'm not going to go beyond what I think is constitutional?
That certainly would be one option, but here's the problem with that. There's no really nice way of putting this, but complaints against people who are engaging in political speech are often used for political reasons. And That costs money, it costs time, and it distracts from the campaign that they're trying to engage in. And if the secretary, the secretary certainly could sit back, and he delegates all of this to the Office of Administrative Courts, and allow the Office of Administrative Courts to interpret these provisions, and then they'd be appealed to this court, and that's, that has happened occasionally, and that has certainly filled in some of the gaps. That is, and not only is it an inefficient process, but it is one that discourages political speech, because as the administrative record in this case demonstrates, when people can't decide, when they can't determine by looking at the rules, by reading campaign finance cases, or hundreds of pages long, when they can't determine what is prohibited and what is not prohibited, they simply don't engage in the speech to begin with.
And let's grant that. Let's say that the intentions were good, but is the power there to do it in this way? I mean, it's what, you know, we can talk about what you've just said, and you know, the point is well taken, but is there the power to do it in a rule?
I think in the First Amendment context, absolutely there is. And I think in the First Amendment context, particularly when you don't have anything in these rules that explicitly contravenes the requirements of the statute, the answer is yes.
So then that would apply to all agencies. All agencies, they can read Supreme Court opinions, and if they think that the statute goes beyond the Supreme Court opinion, then they can write a rule that changes the statute?
There is certainly no doubt. I don't want to speak for any other agencies, and I'd like to focus on the First Amendment if I could. But if you look at the history of what the Secretary of State has done in reaction to Supreme Court decisions in this state, this is not anywhere near the first time that the Secretary's had to do this. It happened in after Colorado Right to Life Committee versus Kaufman, which was a Tenth Circuit case. It happened before that when the Secretary had to adopt former Rule 4.13, which explicitly contravened, I think it's Section 6.2 of the Amendment 27, which covered small ideological organizations that are that were covered by Massachusetts Citizens for Life. Again, this is a lot of this is you can get very deep in the weeds here, but the bottom line is that time and time again, the Secretary of State has taken action to preserve the constitutionality of both statutes and provisions of the Colorado Constitution.
What gave them the power to do that? I mean, the fact you're saying has been, but we've always done it that way, doesn't necessarily say that the power truly exists.
The authority has to be inherent in the Secretary's legislative and constitutional mandate to administer and enforce the Colorado Campaign Finance Code. And you cannot administer and enforce Colorado campaign finance rules if those rules are unenforceable per se.
Let me ask you, Mr. Grubb, does it matter, the examples you gave I think are good ones, where you had a court rule that something was unconstitutional, whether, you know, Massachusetts Right to Life or any of those cases, and it's at least in the examples you gave, the secretary took action based on a court ruling. And, you know, secretary's caught between a rock and a hard place in that situation. I can't enforce something that's unconstitutional. There's I think you can make a compelling argument the secretary needs to act. But what about in a situation where the court, no court has, that's what courts exist for. Court hasn't acted. Can the secretary just on his or her own say, I'm not so sure this rule is clear. I'm concerned about its constitutionality, so let me adopt a rule. That strikes me as beyond, arguably at least beyond the secretary's authority, and that's a distinction that may apply in this case. So would you react to that?
If the secretary were doing that, I would agree with you that Sanger holds that he can't add to, modify, or contravene the statute. But if the statute is unenforceable, and I'll go back to major purpose because that's maybe the most clear example that we have here, then yes, the secretary can do what he's required to, whether he's actually a party to the case or not. If I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, I'd appreciate it.
You may.
May it please the court, my name is Margaret Pearl, registration number 43106. And this is a case that's very big. The basic principle of separation of powers between our three co-equal branches of government in Colorado is what underlies this case. When the secretary enacted the rules at issue in this case, including the electioneering communications rule, which is the subject of the cross appeal, he exceeded his authority, acted as both a judge and a legislator through an administrative rulemaking. And the lower court here saw that the secretary exceeded the authority and did add, modify, or in some cases explicitly contravened the statutory and constitutional provisions that he is charged with administering and enforcing. And that violates Sanger, and that violates other cases about the separation of powers and the role that agencies serve in that greater scheme of our government.
Now, he's bound by the Constitution as well.
Absolutely.
And the United States Supreme Court has made a pronouncement as to the constitutional limitations.
In some cases, yes, Your Honor. And I would say that in general, the lower court decision nor any of our arguments have said that the secretary is not bound to follow the law, the U.S. Constitution, but he's also bound to follow the Colorado Constitution. And in Article 28, our Colorado Constitution gives other values that he has to protect. The value of the right to know, the value of information, the value to cast an informed ballot. And these are also values that he is in charge, that he's charged with enforcing. And to the extent that there are legal interpretations that underlie agency rulemakings, that is not within the agency expertise. It's not a technical rule that is deserving of deference from this court, as you stated before.
Can he take the precise words of the United States Supreme Court decision and put them in a rule, simply to say, this we will be in compliance with this statement by the United States Supreme Court, and simply use those precise words?
If there was a United States Supreme Court directly on point, a United States Supreme Court perhaps about a Colorado statute or a Colorado constitutional provision that was directly on point, made a direct per se facial ruling, which I believe none of the cases that he's talking about here have done to any Colorado statutes and constitution, then I would say perhaps there would be a place to put that down for people to know. However, I think generally it's still within the separation of powers, the place of the people of the state of Colorado to change the Colorado Constitution. If you look at the 10th Circuit holding about major purpose, they say we can't change the Colorado Constitution. And if the 10th Circuit can't do it, I don't believe the secretary has the power to do it either. Now, the secretary offers guidance, the secretary offers information, just similar to the manuals that he puts out, etc. There's no rule saying he can't inform people about judicial precedent that might or might not affect an individual's case.
Well, Ms. Pearl, let me ask you about, I'm sorry, I know you got a head of steam going, but I want to, before you get too far from the Colorado Right to Life Committee case in the 10th Circuit, and I forgot there was a similar case out of division of this court. Those cases, I agree. I mean, of course, the 10th Circuit can't change the Colorado Constitution. But if the 10th Circuit says this to the secretary, you can't enforce this because it would be unconstitutional to enforce it as is. Why? So now we have a ruling from the 10th Circuit. We have a ruling from the Colorado Court of Appeals says the secretary can't enforce this provision without the words major purpose. Mm-hmm. Why can't he write the words major purpose in a rule to make what he's dealing with enforceable?
It is possible, but that's not the rule we have in front of us. And as I believe you pointed out earlier, what has happened here is a rule that creates a major purpose test. To the extent that Colorado Right to Life and other precedent have said we need a major purpose test, it's the decision of the legislature or the voters to create that test. Now,
even if a court has said you have to have it to make it constitutional, I mean, I understood your argument correctly. It could be the Colorado Supreme Court said you have to have a major purpose test or else this is unenforceable. And I think your argument is that we're stuck until the legislature or the people change it. And I guess I'm not sure why that's true. When courts have said this is unconstitutional, I'm not sure you need to go that far for your argument, but why is the secretary stuck in that situation?
Well, I don't believe the secretary is stuck, and let me show how. There are many ways that those kinds of constitutional protections can be taken, and part of it is sort of a case-by-case evaluation. The Colorado Right to Life and the other cases were not facial challenges. It was as-applied challenges. The court opinions, if you look at them, themselves do not articulate this is what major purpose means. These are the three things you need to do. And so to the extent that there is some sort of major purpose gloss that needs to be put on the case-by-case enforcement, we can handle that in case-by-case enforcement. You can handle it through manuals. And in fact, the Buckley case, which created major purpose at the 1976 at the federal level, you can go through the entire Code of Federal Regulations and not find a major purpose regulation. And courts have repeatedly upheld that that is allowable and it does not harm First Amendment rights, including the recent free speech versus FEC case here in the 10th Amendment, that or in the 10th Circuit, rather, that the First Amendment is not harmed by that approach. And what we're saying is, even if you say that that very specific case, and I'll give you that this particular regulation is different, perhaps, than all the others, because you have the clearest possible line from a court case to the language of the Constitution. Even if he had that authority to implement the case ruling, that's not what this rule does. So the trial court, in the lower court opinion, does still say this is an arbitrary and capricious rule. It does not implement the court's ruling. It does not implement a major purpose test which meets that ruling. It disregards things such as contributions to candidates and other things that makes the rule arbitrary under the rulemaking record and under the legal interpretations that he seeks to implement.
So is your argument, even assuming that the secretary had the authority to adopt major purpose, he went too far by kind of trying to define that in ways that are inconsistent? Is that the point you're making?
With regard to political committees, yes, that would
okay.
be a secondary
Okay, yeah, just on
1.18.2. Yes, yes. I believe okay. that the other rules at issue here are even more tenuous. To lean back to Buckley, for example, a 1976 case, as the reason why a political organization statute, which was not even enacted until, excuse me, like 2007, and that Buckley somehow has to now, in 2012, pose limitations on what political organizations in Colorado can do. That's an example of a more tenuous link. But I think the important point here for all of these rules, without getting into the details, is that the agency deference that might traditionally be afforded in a rulemaking is not appropriate here because it's outside the agency expertise. Legal interpretations are subject to de novo review. And when you look at those legal interpretations, and we're in the de novo review, what is consistent across the board is that the secretary's rules misinterpret the First Amendment standards when it comes to constitutional law, because there are a difference between campaign finance rules that impose contribution limitations or prohibitions, and campaign finance rules that merely require disclosure. And the consistent theme across all of these rules is to take the judicial constructs and limitations from cases that deal with contribution limitations and prohibitions and engraft those onto disclosure-only provisions, which is improper, and it narrows the field of disclosure that is required under the Constitution and directly conflicts with the statutory purpose and the constitutional purpose of disclosure under all of these rules. And that is consistent across the board. And this is where the trial court erred with regard to the cross appeal and the electionary communications rule. Because the electionary communications rule, standing alone as a rule adopted in 2012, also misinterpreted the law and was arbitrary and capricious in interpreting older case law to apply still in 2012. And to the extent that the lower court gave extra deference to the agency decision on Rule 1.7 because it was similar to a rule that was enacted in 2007 was improper. Just as looking at all of the other rules, this should have been a de novo legal interpretation of the rules surrounding electionary communications in 2012. Citizens United clearly makes this dichotomy clear about disclosure-only rules. You do not need functional equivalent of express advocacy or express advocacy. That's exactly what was before the court. So to the extent that there's a holding from Citizens United saying that you give a disclosure-only regime, regardless of whether the advertisements or commercials meet any sort of functional equivalent test, then our Colorado Constitution, which the voters have chosen to have disclosure of these advertisements without a functional equivalent of express advocacy test, then the secretary has no authority to come in and impose that limiting provision, that narrows disclosure, and was expressly rejected by the court and Citizens United. And so that, excuse me. And so the lower court erred in looking at the similarity to any prior rule, because the prior rules were prior to Citizens United. And so looking just at the 2012 rule standing alone, it's clear that it's arbitrary and capricious in that it disregards the law in 2012, it disregards the record. And a few points I want to make about that record. The Secretary's counsel makes a point that there was massive numbers of people who are confused and don't know how to comply with the law, and that's simply just not in the rulemaking record. It's a complicated area of law. No one's saying it isn't. But the fact that the rulemaking record doesn't provide a factual basis to make that level of an assertion. And we do have, albeit competing constitutional values, right? We have the First Amendment values, and then we do have these constitutional values in our Colorado Constitution, which no court has stepped forward and said must at all times bend a knee to these other values. And we do not have an individual case that came forward and instigated this rulemaking in 2012. Counsel for the Secretary talks about we've had to do this before because Colorado Right to Life came along and talked about a case. In 2012, there were no cases that came in and said, you've got to recodify all the campaign finance rules. What happened is the Secretary came in and decided to embark on a wholesale recodification, part of it for clarification, numbering, et cetera, but also to take this sort of theme of narrowing disclosure across the board in all of these rules that are in front of the court, and using older precedent, reaching for something to justify narrowing it across the board. This includes the issue committees, where the statute specifically already addresses the major purpose requirement. This includes political organizations, which again is a statutory creation, has defined terms, and basically, as the record shows, the Secretary at the time testified against that statute, and now in rulemaking sought to just disregard the legislature's decisions about political organizations and to have 527 organizations report and disclose their activities, and instead creates a rule that narrows that regulation so much that political committees and political organizations cease to function separately. It completely collapses the distinction between those two groups. And how does it collapse the distinction? By collapsing it from the one disclosure-only scheme of political organizations, which do not require the higher level of scrutiny, do not require things like major purpose and express advocacy, and instead collapses that to be the same as political committees, where you do have that sort of judicial precedent because there are contribution limits and there are prohibitions on what political committees can receive. By collapsing the distinction, it completely undermines the statutory scheme. And that's just one example of how the across-the-board decisions are overall seeking to narrow disclosure in each place. And so because of that, we believe that all of the rules should be viewed as arbitrary and capricious beyond the authority of the Secretary, including the electioneering communications rule that's the subject of the cross appeal. If the judges don't have any other further questions, I'll yield the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grove.
Just want to make a few points. First, the Colorado Constitution does have to bend a knee to the First Amendment. I don't think there's any question about that. And every one of these rules is firmly grounded in either Supreme Court precedent or appellate court precedent. All of it binds the Secretary. A second and related point is that agencies have to make narrowing constructions all the time. And it's particularly important for the Secretary to be able to do so here because Colorado's Constitution sets up a private enforcement mechanism for under which people can bring enforcement actions to challenge whether a political committee or person has engaged in unauthorized expenditures or things that they should have reported. The Secretary can't simply sit back and say, well, this case is okay and this case is not, and provide guidance that way. All that goes through the courts. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you. Thank you to both of you for your cogent arguments. We accept this case as submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.